This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next week, we celebrate Independence Day. Our founding fathers refused to be slaves to the English king, yet some of them owned slaves. My guest Roger Wilkins writes about the founding fathers from an African-American perspective in his new book Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism. He focuses on four Virginians, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Washington, and George Mason. Wilkins writes, "They created a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that whites were and should be supreme. How is one to understand a nation whose dreams the slave owners despoiled even as they were creating it?" Wilkins is descended from enslaved Virginians. He's a professor of history at George Mason University, a longtime civil rights activist, and a former member of the Washington Post's editorial page staff. Let's start with Thomas Jefferson. As the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, he wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness."
That thought was not original to Jefferson. George Mason had written it much less elegantly in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which he had produced at the Virginia Convention just a few weeks before the Declaration was drafted and adopted in Philadelphia. So it was a thought abroad among the rebellious colonists. But Jefferson did it very elegantly, but none of these Virginians thought that they were writing about black people, about women, about Indians. As a matter of fact, from looking at their lives and looking at the origins of their rebellion, it's pretty clear that their aim, those words were aimed at the king and the aristocrats around him in his council. And when they said, "All men are created equal," they were saying, "We colonists are not the country bumpkins you're treating us as. We're not simply economic ciphers to be used for the great maw of the English economy. We are English gentlemen, just as you are. We are your equals. Don't treat us as inferiors." It was not their intention to drop a cloak of equality down over either their wives or of the black people they owned.
You quote one historian who said, "Ironically, it was slavery that made Jefferson free of his tedious, unremunerative law practice and enabled him to devote his energies to American freedom." What's your reaction to that?
Oh, I think it's absolutely true. Their lives were made possible. Their greatness was made possible by slavery. The period from 1765, the Stamp Act crisis, to 1775, where the shots were fired at Lexington and Concord, John Adams called the real American Revolution. And that is the time when many of the colonists changed their minds about who they were. They'd all been born as Englishmen, and they loved England, and they loved the crown. And in that 10-year period, because of the contention, because of the overbearing policies of the king and his council, because of the resistance efforts that the colonists mounted, because of the politics they did, the writing, the studying, the meeting, the organizing, the developing of institutions, and finally the development of a Continental Congress and a Continental Army, all of this took time to read, to study, to discuss. None of this would have been possible for them but for the wealth and the leisure that their slaves provided for them. So that clearly was an accurate reflection. And I think it's kind of funny. Jefferson did start out as a real estate lawyer, and having practiced law myself, I think of real estate law being the least poetic of any profession I can think of, and yet Jefferson turned out to be the poet of the Revolution.
George Washington is one of the founding fathers you write about, and you say he didn't want blacks to join the army. Did he give reasons why? Or did he just assume everybody would agree with him?
Well, Washington was started out as a kind of an ordinary Virginia aspirant to wealth. He was acquisitive. He wanted land. That was how you acquired wealth. In addition, you acquired wealth by marrying a rich widow, and he did that. And you made your land productive by using slaves. And he thought, and slave owners did not like the idea of having black people going around with guns, because they were always worried about slave rebellions. And so when he took command of the army at Cambridge in 1775, he found an army in which blacks were already fighting, because contrary to the way we teach history, blacks were present in every battle of the Revolution, virtually, and certainly they were at Lexington, Concord, and Bunker Hill. Well, that alarmed Washington, the Southerner, now up in Massachusetts, and he said he didn't want him in the army, but manpower needs prevailed. And so you see Washington in 1775 as a very conventional Southern slave owner, and with deeply racist instincts.
Do you think that writing your new book, Jefferson's Pillow, has helped you resolve your feelings about being an African American patriot?
Well, I started out as a patriot. That's the interesting thing. I grew up around civil rights giants. My uncle Roy ran the NAACP for 20 years, and that was his, basically, the NAACP was his life's work. Thurgood Marshall was like an extra uncle to me, and was, when I grew up, a boss, a friend, a colleague at the Justice Department, a mentor, and finally just a dear, dear friend. Martin King and I worked together and so forth. I was kind of the head of the federal government's, certainly part of the civil rights wing of the federal government in the 60s. So, and I realized that that the work we were doing was patriotic work, that it wasn't just the interests of black people that we were pursuing, but the interests of American justice, and we're expanding the meaning of the American Constitution in order to enlarge the structures of opportunity for everybody. So, and that's been the work of my life, and I have embraced it. But I felt, and I knew Thurgood was a thoroughgoing patriot, and I loved him dearly. And I never was easy. Even though I knew I was a patriot, I was never easy with the word patriot until I began to resolve my feelings about these, about the revolution, and also about slavery. And yeah, I have to tell you that having done this work, I embrace the revolution. I even embrace these four slave-owning founders. Well, I embrace three of them. I find it a little hard to embrace Jefferson, but the other three I embraced pretty wholeheartedly.
Why is it that you feel you can embrace Washington, even though he didn't want blacks to join the army during the Revolutionary War, but you still have a hard time embracing Jefferson? They were both slave owners. Jefferson did write, "All men are created equal," even though he was a slave owner. Why are you having such a hard time with Jefferson and not Washington?
I think it's the difference in the moral content of their character, as Martin King would put it. Jefferson was obviously a brilliant man, and had a great talent for writing, and his writing could soar when his passions were engaged. But over his lifetime, you don't get any sense of moral growth. You get sometimes moral anguish. He was able to talk about his belief that blacks would someday be free, and He was able to talk about the fruits of freedom for everybody, but he could also pen a terribly racist screed, as he did in Notes on the State of Virginia. And in the end, he just indulged himself by leaving Washington's cabinet, and he indulged himself by buying all his French stuff, wine, furniture, and so forth, and got into debt, had to sell slaves. And his slaves were scattered to the winds because of his debts when he died. Washington, on the other hand, grew from a fellow who had only wealth and dandy aspirations as a young man to a man who shouldered willingly the heaviest burdens his society could lay on him. And he did it with a strength of character that is just astounding. And he did it decade after decade. And at the same time, he showed moral growth. He turned against slavery. First, he became a good slave owner. That is, he wouldn't sell slaves because he thought it was cruel, even though that meant that the slave population at Mount Vernon would grow and he would just go deeper and deeper into debt because Mount Vernon was no longer, with all of those slaves, a profitable proposition. And then at the end of his life, he, six months before he died, he changed his will and he freed the slaves. But you freed the slaves at his death, after his death. In Washington, you see a man who brought less talent, but more strength of character and a deep moral sensibility. You feel in Washington's life a mulling of character issues that goes on and on and on and on. In Jefferson's life, you feel a deviousness, a craftiness, a self-regard. And in the end, though the revolution would not have had the frills and flourishes that it had because of Jefferson, you don't, at least in the period which I look at, and that is up to the death of Washington, you do not sense the kind of moral growth that you sensed in Washington.
My guest is Roger Wilkins. His new book is called Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Roger Wilkins, and his new book is called Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers and the Dilemma of Black Patriotism. You were one of the leaders in America of the fight against apartheid in South Africa. Did some of the documents of the Founding Fathers, about who you're so ambivalent because they were slaveholders, did some of their documents kind of help you in that fight and help you find the right words and all of that?
The words of the Founding Fathers and their works have helped me my entire life. Thurgood taught me when I first worked for him as a law student. A kind of reverence for the Constitution of the United States. And therefore, I got early on a deep interest in James Madison. Throughout my lifetime, those words. But in the Free South Africa movement, I led demonstrations along with my colleagues in front of the South African embassy. At times, it was really tough. There were not many people there. It was cold or rainy, things like that. One day I was doing it, and I was feeling particularly silly, and people were driving home along Massachusetts Avenue and looking at us like we were a bunch of nuts, and I felt awkward and exposed. And I said to myself, "What's wrong with you? You're leading these people. Why are you feeling this way? All you're doing is exercising your rights as a citizen under the Constitution of the United States, and you're an active citizen, and you're doing things on behalf of people who half a world away, who if they tried to do it in their capital for themselves, would at least end up in jail and perhaps would be killed." I had not studied Mason and the Declaration of Rights at that point, but it was Mason's spirit. It's the things that he wrote, the things that Madison wrote, the constitutional structure that those founders created that made me so sure as I marched up and down that street and did what I did that these were fundamental rights of an American citizen, and by God, I'm proud to be doing that. And those people who were passing in cars and comfort to their homes out in the Maryland suburbs were jerks if they didn't understand the glories of American citizenship. These things are my legacies as an American citizen that I owe to these founders, including the slave-owning founders. Maybe they didn't expect that some descendant of slaves would use these rights in that way, but they knew that they were letting loose in the world a ground for creative citizenship. That's what they had in mind. That's what I've tried to live, and I have to be grateful for that bequest. It's made my life. It's made the kind of life that I've lived possible.
You mentioned that you learned your reverence for the Constitution from Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, who was like an uncle to you. I think it's interesting that you learned your reverence from somebody who, you know, was such an important African-American figure in American history. In other words, you weren't learning your reverence from a white person who you would imagine wouldn't really understand the kind of ambivalence that you feel about the Founding Fathers. You learned it from Thurgood Marshall, who I'm sure could understand your ambivalence and probably felt a lot of it too. Did you talk about this kind of thing with him?
I didn't talk about anything with Thurgood except what he wanted me to do when I was working with him. But
right.
I watched him, and I watched his life, and I listened to the way he would talk about the Constitution when he was shaping an argument or when he was arguing with somebody on the telephone or whatever we happened to be doing. And I understood that he loved this Constitution. And there were white men on the staff, Jack Greenberg and Bill Taylor, who loved the Constitution just as deeply, but Thurgood was the mentor and the boss of us all, and then the fact that he became a lifelong friend just happened to, it embedded those values in me.
Do you find, as a professor, that you have a hard time convincing some of your African-American students that the Founding Fathers are worth caring about, or that some of the, you know, founding documents of the United States are worth caring about?
There's really an interesting connection. I teach in a way, the way Thurgood taught me to teach, and that is when I teach black students or white students these things, I bring to the teaching the experiences of my life, like marching in front of the South African embassy and suddenly realizing that what I'm doing is a birthright from these founders, many of whom were slaveholders, and feeling warmed by that. And when I tell that story, black and white students get it. They really get it, that these rights are real things, real values in their lives should they choose to become active citizens, and they came from these people. So, no, I don't find student resistance when I'm able to really put it across in vivid ways.
Do you know if any of your ancestors, any of your family, were slaves at the time of the Founding Fathers?
I don't. I know that my father's family was enslaved in Mississippi in the middle of the 19th century, as early as the middle of the 19th century, but beyond that, we can't go. My mother's family, I suspect, was enslaved much earlier because my great-grandfather, her grandfather lived in Virginia in the early part of the 19th century, and he was light-skinned, free, and literate, which meant that there was probably quite a long history before that, and my guess would be that he was the third or fourth generation in the family. So yes, I suspect that that part of my family was here during the Revolution.
Roger Wilkins, thank you so much for talking with us.
I've enjoyed this very much, Terry. Thank you.
Roger Wilkins is the author of Jefferson's Pillow, The Founding Fathers, and The Dilemma of Black Patriotism. He's a professor of history at George Mason University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.